Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for May 2014. This is issue 352. I'm your host, Fred Vobey. The address for the DX Audio Service is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805. My email address for general inquiries is fvobe, that's F-V-O-B-B-E, at realoldiesradio.com. My telephone number for short calls is 419-228-6223. That number is not to be used for musings or to leave reports to the DX Audio Service. The musings number is 419-741-0205. A yearly subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S. and Canadian members is $30, and the magazine is published on CDs. To subscribe or renew, make your check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or you can log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using PayPal. If you're on the internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal. Subscribe only if you're able to download and navigate a website without anyone else's assistance. Before we get into the DX Audio Service for this month, a note from headquarters says that the AM radio log number 34 is officially sold out. AM radio log number 35 should be ready by Labor Day of 2014. And with that, let's turn the microphone over to Dave Alpert with a look at the AM switch.
Hi everyone, Dave Alpert with the AM switch. This issue we have two editions. AM Switch Volume 81, Issues 24 and 25. Starting off, as usual, with Call Letter Bingo. 740 KCMC Texarkana, Texas changes to KTFS, but this call will show up in a moment. 850 WWJC Duluth, Minnesota changes to WQRM. 940 KTFS Texarkana, Texas makes a call change to KCMC. 1160 WJFJ Tryon, North Carolina has changed to WWQT, which may signal that it's coming back on the air. The new station on 1230 in Terre Haute, Indiana will be WYGJ. And the new station on 1250 in Kalua'i, Hawaii has been granted KEWE. 1260 KTRP Weiser, Idaho changes to KWEI. 1300 WBOW Terre Haute, Indiana changes to WIBQ. 1300 KWCK Searcy, Arkansas is now KRZS. 1300 WIMO Winder, Georgia changes to WJBB. This is a surprise. The longtime call on 1330 in Willoughby, Ohio was WELW, and they've dropped that to become WINT. 1340 WHTD Mountain City, Georgia changes to WNGM. By the way, the station is still silent. 1390 KWOD Salem, Oregon changes to KZZD. 1450 KWEI Notice, Idaho switches to KTRP. And 1660 KUDL Kansas City, Kansas is now KWOD. Taking a look at new stations, we have one new construction permit granted, 1340 in Fairbanks, Alaska, with U1, 1,000 watts day and night. Who will be the first to log this one? New CPs applied for, 920 WDMC, Melbourne, Florida, applies for U4, 8 kilowatts day, 4 kilowatts at night from a new site. 1240 WLLV Louisville, Kentucky applies for U1, 530 watts day and night, moving their transmitter to WLOU 1350's site. Application to amend existing CPs for new stations. The 1590 CP in Paradise, Nevada was for U2, 6500 watts day and 1100 watts night, but they've applied for U4, 10,000 watts day and 320 watts night. and changed the city of license to Enterprise, Nevada, from a new transmitter site. We have one station to report in the application dismissed department. 1280 KFRN, Long Beach, California's application for U4, 500 watts day, 400 watts night, from a new site, was dismissed by the FCC. Construction permit for new station expired. 1590 WODJ, Big Rapids, Michigan, was a CP for a new station, U4, 1,000 watts day, 920 at night, and the CP expired without being built, so WODJ's CP was deleted. Stations going dark or not, 960 WPLY, Mount Pocono, Pennsylvania, received a letter from the FCC saying it considers license canceled for being silent for more than a year. WPLY was last heard back on June 27th, 2011. We'll assume it's still that way. 990 WALE, Greenville, Rhode Island. No joke, their license was canceled on April 1st after not filing a renewal application. 1540 WBRY, Woodbury, Tennessee. Their license has been reinstated as of April 4th because the previous license expired August 1st, 2012 because the station's original renewal application wasn't processed for failure to pay the fee. They're now back on the air and will get a new license after a $7,000 fine. 1550 WBSC, Bennettsville, South Carolina. Their license was canceled after being silent since October 6, 2011. Now WBSC is finally deleted from the FCC database. Moving on to construction permits for existing stations. Let's start off with CPs on the air. 590 WLES, Bonaire, Virginia. On with U1, 1,000 watts day and 58 at night. 680 WGES, St. Petersburg, Florida. U1, 930 watts day, 165 at night, is on the air. 1080 WRYT, Edwardsville, Illinois. Their CP for U7, 500 watts day, 20 watts night, and critical hours power of 380 watts is on the air. 1340 KRMD, Shreveport, Louisiana, is on with U1, 400 watts day and night, and 1600 WTZQ in Hendersonville, North Carolina, has their CP on with U1, 5 kilowatts day, 30 watts night. These stations have their CPs built and are waiting for a license from the FCC. 1010 WKJW, Black Mountain, North Carolina, U1, 47,000 watts day and 90 watts night, from a new site. 1360 WMOB, Mobile, Alabama, applies for a license on their CP for U4, 9,000 watts day and 200 at night. And 1550 KDCO, Golden, Colorado, has been granted program test authority for their CP. The station will be U2, 990 watts day and 350 watts night. CPs granted, 820 WNYC, New York, granted a CP for U4, 10,000 watts day and 930 at night. 1450 KVSL, Sholo, Arizona, granted a CP for U1, 5,000 watts day and 87 watts night, with a switch up the dial to 1470. CP applications. 1570 WVTK, Vermilion, South Dakota, applies for U1, 500 watts day and 53 watts night, from a new transmitter site. CPs canceled. 1100 WISS, Berlin, Wisconsin's CP for D4, 50,000 watts, and critical hours power of 20,000 watts was not built, and it expired, and the FCC deleted it. So WISS stays D1, 2,500 watts, and critical hours power, 1,600 watts. Amendments to pending applications. 700 KFIR, Sweet Home, Oregon, is licensed with U1, 10 kilowatts day and 184 watts at night, with a pending application for U1, 10,000 watts day and 225 watts night, from a new site. KFIR now amends their application to U1, 10,000 watts day and 146 watts night, because the original application caused impermissible QRM to KIRO 710 in Seattle. 780 WBBM Chicago has an application for auxiliary transmitter with U1 12,500 watts day and night, and now amends that application to U1 13,000 watts day and night. This auxiliary site is southwest of Bloomingdale, Illinois. The normal 50,000 watt site is about 20 miles northeast of Bloomingdale. And before we leave the land of CPs, we have a correction. We had reported that the CP for Blackhawk, South Dakota was on 690. The CP for this new station is actually 960, the typo monster, which had an 1120 station on 1020, apparently got us again, and we can blame it all on Fred Volby and his years of being near high-power RF. Just kidding, Fred. Special Temporary Authority, 680, WKAZ, Charleston, West Virginia, granted an STA with U1, 10,000 watts day, 55 at night, as they lost a tower to wind back on March 28th and 29th. 940 WCPC, Houston, Mississippi, granted a STA for U1, 10,000 watts day and 7 at night. 1000 WRQR, Paris, Tennessee, granted an STA with D1, 500 watts while installing an FM translator on their tower. 1040 WCHR, Flemington, New Jersey, has been granted an STA with parameters at variance, so this may be a DX opportunity. 1060 KRUZ, Van Buren, Arkansas, has an STA with D1 25 watts from a temporary long wire antenna. Not sure of the circumstances. 1340 KTSN, Elko, Nevada, is granted STA with reduced power from a backup transmitter. 1380 WPYR, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, has an STA due to parameters at variance, meaning their pattern monitoring system needs repair. 1380 WKJV, Asheville, North Carolina, is granted an STA with U1, 25,000 watts day and 250 watts night, as someone borrowed their copper ground system and never brought it back. Probably never will. 1430 WENE, Endicott, New York, is granted an STA with U1, 5,000 watts day, 1,250 watts night, or parameters at variance, having unidentified problems with their night pattern. 1460 WRAD, Radford, Virginia, has an STA with U1, 5,000 watts day, 125 watts night, during tower work. 1470 WBCR, Alcoa, Tennessee, has an application to use a CP U1 1,000 watts day and 77 watts night from a new site under an STA dismissed. 1480 KYOS, Merced, California, granted an STA with U3 5,000 watts day and night using the night pattern 24 hours due to antenna switching problems. 1530 WOBX, Wanchese, North Carolina, granted an STA with D1 250 watts because of their phasing unit being inoperative. 1550 WVAB, Virginia Beach, Virginia, needed an STA with U1 6 watts day and night from a temporary antenna. We suspect a tower collapse or they lost their sight. 1590 WEHH, Elmira Heights, Horseheads, New York, granted an STA for U5 3,500 watts day, 170 at night, due to phasing issues. 1690 KYOK, Katy, Texas, is granted an STA to operate on 1690 with D5 5,000 watts, solely to test ground conductivity for this 1140 kilohertz station with a construction permit moving from Conroe to Katy. This might be a very interesting station to try logging. The FCC dismissed two recent applications for new stations just before airtime, and they are 1490 Orchard Homes, Montana, U1, 1,000 watts day, 670 watts night, and 1570 Ettrick, Virginia, U2, 9,000 watts day and 700 watts night. Both of these applications are dismissed, so erase them out of your logbook. We'll see if they refile. Time now for the obituaries, or as we call them, silent stations. These are stations informing the FCC they are silent. 1040 KURS, San Diego, California. Silent per recently amended license renewal application. 1060 KRUZ, Van Buren, Arkansas. Silent again back on March 15th as they lost their permanent tower site. 1260 KIMB, Kimball, Nebraska is silent due to a problem with their antenna system. 1340 KJMU, Sand Springs, Oklahoma went silent March 14th to replace equipment. 1340 KIKO, Miami, Arizona is silent due to a power surge knocking the station off the air and damaging the transmitter. 1450 WBVA, Bayside, Virginia has been silent since April 2, 2013. They returned to the air March 21st with an STA, then went silent again on March 25th. 1550 WVAB, Virginia Beach, Virginia has been silent since April 8, 2013. They returned to the air March 25th with an STA and went silent again April 4th. And 1580 WNTF, Bithlow, Florida is silent effective March 21st due to transmitter failure. These are formerly silent stations which have informed the FCC they are no longer silent. 750 WPDX Clarksburg, West Virginia. 1160 KRDY San Antonio, Texas. 1270 WSHE Columbus, Georgia. And 1480 WQTM Fair Bluff, North Carolina. If you heard a cash register ring from Washington, D.C., that means it's FCC fines. WLBH 1170 Mattoon, Illinois was fined for failure to maintain antenna enclosure for AM and FM towers. The fine was reduced from $14,000 to $500 for lack of ability to pay. KFSD 1450 Escondido, California was denied a petition for reconsideration of a $4,800 fine for failure to maintain emergency alert system equipment. WQQX 1490 East St. Louis, Missouri and WQQW 1510 Highland, Illinois, stations which are co-owned, were fined for failure to maintain public inspection file. The fine was reduced from $24,000 to $8,500 for inability to pay. WTRI 1520 Brunswick, Maryland fined $5,000 for not reporting its silent periods to the FCC, but in a quirk of fate, they got a full license renewal anyway. WDJZ 1530 Bridgeport, Connecticut is fined $10,000 for failure to maintain antenna enclosure. And a pirate bust is in the news. U.S. Marshals seized the equipment of a for-profit pirate radio station in the Bronx in Manhattan, Rika FM. Had commercial space on 181st Street in the Bronx, from which it, quote, illegally aired its programs on 94.5 and 94.9. According to the U.S. attorney, the second location was 1370 St. Nicholas Avenue in Manhattan near the George Washington Bridge. Spanish language, Rika FM was using 95.3 and 100.3 from that residential building. FCC agents and the marshals seized the equipment on April 12th. Look for big fines to the owners of those stations. Canadian news by the just-out-of-hospital Dan Siss and Sean Axelrod. 530 CIAO, Brampton, Ontario, has been granted a CP for U1, they were U3, 1,000 watts day and 250 watts night. 650 CISL, Richmond, British Columbia, applies for a new site, which is actually the old 600 Vancouver site. And 1340 CKDR1 in Ignace, Ontario, applies to move to 97.5 FM and delete the AM station. Thanks to Sean Axelrod, Bill Hale, Fred Volbe, and Glenn Hauser for this issue of AM Switch. I'm Dave Alpert in sunny California, and we'll see you next month on the AM Switch. Remember, if you know of any changes, call the Musings line and let us know. 419-741-0205. Now, keeping you in the know, here's Mark Durenberger.
Dave, thank you, and welcome all as we continue reporting that Western band scan in which we were sweeping the Pacific coast, picking and choosing from a plethora of stations, most of which we've never captured. Back in March, we introduced the hot new Double Delta antenna, and you'll recall we got through 710, I think, with our sampling. Before we begin, just another reminder to join us in the iListen tally that Fred's been talking about. We know you're listening to us either on CD or downloading us from the EDXN website, and we are trying to get an accurate head count. So you can help if you haven't done so. If you are downloading from the EDXN website, please send Fred Vobey a note at the address mentioned earlier, and all you have to do is say, "I listen." Of course, add any comments you may wish that might be appropriate, but the main thing is we want to get an idea of who's listening in which media, so thank you in advance for that. And a personal note as we get started. From time to time, we try to do some critical listening to these columns as they're published, and after listening to the first part of this band scan on the March DX audio service, I noticed how shrill most of the station IDs had become. About a year ago, I endured what's called by the doctors an acute acoustic injury. It was caused by an explosion, and my hearing was immediately greatly reduced. I think what happened in the March column was that I was adjusting the sound of the IDs to make up for that hearing loss. And that's the wrong thing to do, and we apologize. And hopefully today's IDs will sound a bit more balanced. Looking at our preview list as we monitored the recordings we had captured, boy, we note we have more than 60 stations still to report. And we're not going to get all those in, and you're probably not interested. So we're going to do some triage and bring forth only those more interesting catches and explain to you along the way why they're considered worth the time and trouble. I don't know how far we're going to get picking and choosing, but if we need to, we'll finish on a future column. In a few months, we'll also show you what happened when we reversed the antenna system just before sunset and sucked in signals from east of us, nulling out those from the west. For today, though, let's pick up where we left off, and I think that was at around 710. So we're going to go to 750 for the Hog from Fallon, Nevada. And right off the bat, an interesting catch, because it demonstrates something we've never discussed, and that's the vertical reception characteristics of an antenna. Let's go to class, okay, Terry Livingston Hughes? We're used to visualizing radio signals and antenna pickup by their effectiveness in the horizontal plane. We know that as a flat, two-dimensional concept from the tower on out to a certain distance in a certain direction with a signal having a certain coverage shape based on the antenna. But all antennas have varying sensitivities in the vertical plane as well as the horizontal. Now, if you point your finger toward the ceiling and visualize it as a radio antenna, the signals coming straight at your finger from the sides would be those that are defined by the usual coverage maps. That's the two dimensions. Now, visualize signals that bounce off the ceiling and hit your finger at some angle other than straight on. Now, we're dealing with the vertical or elevation characteristic. And all antennas deliver different elevation sensitivity, whether they're a transmit antenna or a receive antenna. In the case of transmitting antennas, those signals that go off at an angle are called skywave, and they hit the ionosphere at different angles, creating different bounces and landing back on the Earth in different locations. What determines that characteristic and behavior is usually the height of the antenna. On the receive side, that sensitivity varies from the ground to the top of the antenna, and signals hitting the antenna will be different in strength depending on the angle at which they arrive. This is the secret of why skywave signals can be so surprising, because from day to day, the signal arrives at a different angle according to the behavior of the ionosphere. A strong signal coming at us one evening might be totally absent the next night because that skywave bounce has changed, and the new arrival angle means it strikes our antenna at a point that's less sensitive. The 750 reception is a case in point. If the antenna had uniform elevation characteristics, where it was sensitive regardless of the angle, we should have heard KOAL in Price, Utah, almost next door, because its ground wave signal was coming right at the antenna, but horizontally. We said our particular antenna likes higher elevation angles better. KHOG, KHWG, has bounced some skywave toward us, and that skywave is apparently coming down at the right angle where our antenna is most sensitive. This may sound complicated, but the results speak for themselves. 750 on the radio, with the antenna looking right at Price, Utah, but no KOAL. Instead, from a farther distance away, a long distance away, comes KHWG bouncing off the ionosphere and arriving at our antenna.
Nailed him to the tree. Oh, sometimes it causes me to tremble. Were you there?
Traveling with KHWG 750 AM Fallon.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
QED, as the scholars say, class dismissed. Oh no, don't go. More fun ahead. On 780 KAZM comes up from Sedona. They're still on day power in Arizona at the time of capture, but starting to get beat on by KKOH Reno as it starts to get dark toward the west.
This is your Northern Arizona news, talk, sports, and music leader, AM 780, KAZM Sedona.
Sunset is approaching Bakersfield, California, while KBFP on 800 was still on day power, but again starting to be heard by Skywave. A much closer signal in Idaho, KBRV should have been dominant, but that same 750 effect is at play. Idaho is far closer and still arriving more or less horizontally, while Bakersfield was coming in at an angle where the vertical sensitivity of our antenna proved to be an advantage.
Sunday Night Football is next on most of these same stations. I'm Scott Graham. Thanks for joining us from Westwood One. This is NFL Sunday. This is 24/7 comedy.
Here's your number one.
Yes, what can you do?
Comedy 800 is KBFC Bakersfield.
Following the presentation of Westwood One Sports. It's Sunday Night Football. It's Westwood One. Tonight, the Dallas Cowboys and the New Orleans Saints.
Freeze takes the snap, drops the throw from his one.
Then we jump to 8:30 for Grass Valley, where we'll hear KNCO. This recorded while KNCO was still on day power, but the path to Grass Valley was just starting to open via the ionosphere.
Deemed as a buyer and seller of bullion, placer, nuggets, sterling, platinum, palladium, and jewelry. Gift here at Golden Coin at Call at 272-1100 or stop by the store at 203 West Main Street in downtown Grass Valley.
KNCO, Grass Valley, Nevada City.
Lars Larson has more today in only 6 minutes. It's 6 o'clock.
From ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu.
Now we come to a different example. Boy, this is fun. We have KXNT in Las Vegas and KMPH Modesto, California on 840. Las Vegas is a lot closer, but guess what? Here's a case of both stations sending us Skywave, but at different angles. And the angle of the Skywave from Modesto wins the day.
Presented by AM and FM.
KMPH,
And on a different night, or even at a different time that same night, it could have been the other way around quite easily. That's why DXing is such a rewarding hobby. You never know what's going to be happening. Now, we don't want to think only of these elevation angles. Let's go back to the basic premise that the major horizontal lobe, and for that matter the elevation pickup, is still oriented to the west-southwest by virtue of where we put the antenna, how we set it up, and what direction it's pointing. To demonstrate how well this antenna works in the south-southwest direction, we can do nothing more dramatic than checking out 850. Powerhouse KOA Denver dominates the frequency, but it's coming from the east, the dead side of the antenna. So, here's a reality check. KOA when we listen to the east, then we'll switch the antenna null system in and look to the west on 850.
Get traffic updates after the game and every 10 minutes tomorrow morning on your way to work on 850 KOA.
Oh, the Spanish? That was XEZF1 in Mexicali at 250 watts. And again, let's check that east null on 880. KRVN, Lexington, normally does an 11 here if we're listening to the east. Pointed west, though, our antenna hears KHAC in San Benito, New Mexico, as it switches to night pattern at 430 watts. Not much left after that switch of San Benito, but no KRVN either.
My cup overflows. Surely, goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in heaven.
Let's see what else may be of interest. Oh, here's 910 looking west. Once again, there's a station in the way, KWDZ in Salt Lake City. But once again, we jump right over that one for KKSF, fairly new call letters, in Oakland. The ID, and then into the news, we'll hear their pattern and power change. KKSF will drop from 20 kilowatts to 5. Their signal continues to point away from us. You should hear the power change.
Download iHeartRadio on your smartphone now to listen. iHeartRadio Talk is presented by Chevrolet. Find new roads.
If it affects you, it affects us. More live and local than any other talk station in the Bay. Talk 910, San Francisco's talk station. With more live and local talk in the Bay, Talk 910 is San Francisco's talk station. KKSF, Oakland, San Francisco, San Jose. Online at talk910.com.
News Radio. I'm Lisa Lucera. President Obama offering condolences and sending in the Marines to aid the super typhoon in the Philippines. It's feared thousands are dead.
In some of the places, there's mass graves of 300 to 500 to 200 people. It's just getting to such a point that we stopped counting the bodies. And as the Philippine president says, the goal is now to help the living.
On 920, nearby KEVL, Vernal, Utah. Nowhere around, normally a pest. Again, the antenna is liking the higher angle stuff better. So instead of KEVL, we benefit from a high angle skywave hop from Las Vegas.
Get them at the Orleans box office, OrleansArena.com, or by calling 284-7777. That's 284-7777.
KBAD Las Vegas.
The Milwaukee Brewers' Polish sausage has admitted to steroid use and sausage race fixing.
Sports 920. 920. The game. The game.
This is your NBC Sports Radio update.
The Broncos win again.
Well, let's see here. We sort of ho-hum up the dial till we land on 1020 Los Angeles. We're including this one only because it's a first for us. It's fun to hear Spanish when there are no Spanish words for English nouns.
KCAQ, Los Ángeles, Univisión América, 1020 AM. Las noticias que impactan a los Estados Unidos nacen en Univisión América.
Bienvenidos a Sunday Night Football y tremendo choque que tenemos para ustedes. El equipo de América, Dallas Cowboys, contra los Saints. Dan Orleans desde el Mercedes-Benz Superdome, sede del Super Bowl 47, y definitivamente dos equipos que están peleando para definir sus posiciones en la posible postemporada, ya que queda todavía mitad de temporada y todavía mucho fútbol por jugar.
And by the way, what we should have heard on 1020 was nearby Roswell, New Mexico, but nowhere to be heard. To 1080 KSLL, right in the way to our west, but no. Instead, we hopped right over that for KSCO Santa Cruz. You'll hear some KNX sidebands on this one.
Huh?
What'd he say? Eleven hundreds of terrific interest. There's a local right behind us, Powerhouse KNZZ. I mean, literally, just a few miles east of us. But because it's east, there's nothing there on the antenna. Tracking the Sunset Terminator, the path is opening to the west in time to hear on 1100, instead of our local KNZZ, KWWN Las Vegas, before it switches to night power. And then on a later recording, as dark is approaching San Francisco, we hear KFAX coming in over Las Vegas and a couple of others on 1100. So in order here, what you're going to hear, the nearby 1100 powerhouse as we heard it with a short piece of wire. Then we switch west, KWWN, and a bit later, KFAX in San Francisco.
You updated at the top and bottom of every hour. News Radio 1100, KNZZ, Grand Junction.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lisa Lucero.
Stay tuned. Sunday night football is next on most of the same stations. I'm Scott Graham. Thanks for joining us for Westwood One. This is NFL Sunday.
Get special introductory offers now at the new OfficeMax Services Center. You'll find over 60 print services. Learn more in-store or at OfficeMax.com/services.
And I have radio station. A service of Salem Communications.
Anyone who's DX'd west of the Mississippi has come across perennial powerhouse KFAB on 1110.
This is KFAB Omaha. And online at KFAB.com.
Until you get to the Pacific Coast states, they own the channel. Their nighttime skywave is as steady as a daytime signal. That's why it was fun to blow them away with our directional antenna in favor of Bend, Oregon.
KBND, FM News 100, AM News 1110. The most news, traffic, weather, and stimulating talk 24-7. KBND, Bend.
Radio. I'm Lisa Lucero. The typhoon that devastated the Philippines has made landfall in Vietnam. It has weakened since cutting a path through the Philippines where thousands are believed to have died. Damage unimaginable.
Boy, I'd say we got enough. I don't think we can jam much more into this month's report. So we'll call what the newspaper people call a 30 on this column and hope to see you again next month. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service, and we thank you for joining us every month or so at this time. A reminder, as we said, it's important to understand how you're getting the program, and we hope you'll let us know. Quick email to Fred, that's FVOBE, FVOBBE at realoldiesradio.com. All you need to do is put in the subject line, I listen. That'll tell us that you're downloading the program. And please be assured, we're not trying to create a new mailing list, and we won't contact you nor put your name on any future list. We're simply trying to tally where you're listening. So send that email right now, won't you? Many of you have not yet done so. Feel free to add any comments if you wish, but may we also ask if you've already responded? Don't do it again, or we may count you twice, and Fred will get an inaccurate head count. Thanks for doing this for us, and we'll see you in 30 days. I'm going to get out of the way now for the rest of the DX Audio Service. And until we connect again, good listening, DXers. National Radio Club.
Local indie stores celebrate their own savior this weekend, Record Store Day. This story was written by Bob Cunningham, who is a Toledo Blade staff writer. The calendar says there is just one holiday this weekend, but the calendar is wrong. Taking place the day before Easter is Record Store Day. It's a savior of sorts for the independent music shops. Area record stores annually depend on the international event to keep the doors open and the records spinning, including a new store in East Toledo, Ohio. Friendly Beavers Records, at 136 Main Street in Toledo, opened on January the 1st. A precarious time to start a business that depends on foot traffic. We opened at the beginning of a record-setting, sorry the pun, snow season, so it's been kind of slow going, said Brock Curry, president of Innovative Concerts, which books concerts at several area venues, including Friendly Beaver's Neighbors, Main Street Bar and Grill, and Frankie's Inner City. Curry, who operated the former Shaken Street Records on Adams Street for about 5 years, says that he is using Record Store Day as an opportunity to relaunch the new music store, especially with all the bad weather. We've been closed about half the time, he said. Last year's event was the biggest event we ever had at Shaken Street, so we hope that this will help things here. The reason Curry closed Shaken Street and opened Friendly Beaver was to help centralize all his business interests, said Curry, who has an office at Headliners, a club on North Detroit Avenue. And I like the idea of starting fresh, so that's what we did, he said of the move and the name change. Friendly Beaver Records operates in what was previously an apartment in a storefront for about 8 years, Curry said. And it was trashed. We renovated it in like a month and a half and are happy with how it turned out. This year, Record Store Day happens to coincide with 419 Day, which celebrates the Buy Local movement in the Toledo area, and Curry sees that as an added benefit. 419, by the way, is the area code for Toledo, Ohio. Even though the 7th annual Record Store Day is a chance for avid fans of records to add hundreds of titles and special releases to their collection, such as this year's Cake Box set and the Ghostbusters 30th anniversary soundtrack re-release on glowing vinyl, it's all about the record store's vitality. It's our biggest day of the year by far, said Erica McClure, who works at Finders Records in Bowling Green, Ohio, home of Bowling Green State University. The biggest misconception is it's just the day to get special limited edition records. It helps keep independent record stores in business. Rob Kimple, who owns Ramalama Records, which will celebrate its 10th anniversary with a concert next month in West Toledo, agreed that it is by far the biggest day for us, and the overall resurgence of the medium has helped too. We always sold vinyl, but people are looking for it in leaps and bounds now. It's probably overtaken our CD sales.
Kimple said that RSD customers range in age everywhere from preteens to septuagenarians. Other indies are also participating in the event, including the four area Allied Record Exchange Stores and Culture Clash Records, which was part of the coalition of stores that started Record Store Day, according to store buyer Shane Shirley. Maybe the best thing Record Store Day has done has given indie stores a chance to compete with the big chains and the superstores. Big box stores don't usually do vinyl, Curry said. It's been a boon for the mom and pop stores. It's just a better experience, a more personal experience. But a little nostalgia doesn't hurt either. Music lovers want to come out to a store like this where you can hold the records in your hands and enjoy the experience, Curry said. Gabe Beam, manager of the South Reynolds location of Allied Records, says, "Every day is a Record Store Day for us." In addition to the event specials, he says his store will have a sidewalk sale, weather permitting, to unload some of the store's overstock. Customers have been known to show up very, very early, similar to Black Friday, Rob Kimple of Ramalama Records said. His first customer got in line at 6:30 a.m. last year. Record Store Day was written by Bob Cunningham of the Toledo Blade, and he can be contacted at bcunningham@theblade.com or 419-724-6506.
WPDQ 60 Radio.
This is a story on numbers stations on shortwave from the BBC News magazine on BBC.com. This is the era of hypertech espionage, encrypted emails, and mind-boggling cryptography. But you can hear a very old-fashioned form of espionage on shortwave radio. It is 1303 on a Tuesday in a cramped room with some fairly advanced radio equipment. What is suddenly heard on a shortwave receiving station is a 10-minute message in Morse code. There's a small community of aficionados who believe messages like this are a throwback to the era of Cold War espionage. They are the mysterious numbers stations. At the apex of the Cold War, radio lovers across the globe started to notice bizarre broadcasts on the airwaves, starting with a weird melody or the sound of several beeps. These transmissions might be followed by the unnerving sound of a strange woman's voice counting in German, or the creepy voice of a child reciting letters in English. Encountering these shortwave radio messages, many radio hams concluded they were being used to send coded messages across extremely long distances. Coming across one of them was a curious experience. Radio enthusiasts gave them colorful names like the Nancy Adam Susan, the Lincolnshire Poacher, the Swedish Rhapsody, or the Gong Station. The Lincolnshire Poacher was so named because of two bars from an English folk song of that name being used as an interval signal. The Swedish Rhapsody?
Thank you.
judge for yourself. Times have changed and technology has evolved, but there's evidence that this old-fashioned seeming method of communication might still be used. Shortwave number stations might seem low-tech, but they probably remain the best option for transmitting information to agents in the field, some espionage experts suggest. Nobody has found a more convenient and expedient way of communicating with an agent, says Rupert Allison, an author specializing in espionage issues and writing under the pen name Nigel West. Their sole purpose is for intelligence agencies to communicate with their agents in denied areas, a territory where it's difficult to use a consensual form of communications, Allison says. A former GCHQ officer who does not wish to be named, whose duty was to intercept signals toward the UK and search for these number stations in the 1980s, is also adamant that these were broadcasts to agents in the field or in residencies or directed to embassies. It was one-way traffic. The transmitters broadcast numbers to the recipient. The recipient did not reply. Why might the numbers stations have been used? This system is completely secure because the messages can't be tracked. The recipient could be anywhere, says Joaquin Fernandez, the creator of the CONET project, a comprehensive archive of the phenomenon of number stations. It's easy, he says. You just send the spies to a country and get them to buy a radio. They know where to tune and when. Fernandez was fascinated by the mysteries of number stations. It was so weird I wanted to know more about them, he says. He put 3 years of his life aside in order to put together a coherent archive of these stations. Once you hear them, it has an effect on you, he says. I never expected to be talking about it 17 years after hearing it for the first time when the CONET project first started. Unlike other aspects of the Cold War era, the number stations didn't leave a lasting impression on popular culture. It's a dry subject until you listen to them, Fernandez says. It's a way of communicating securely between the Secret Intelligence Service and agents, and it's incomprehensible, says Philip Davies, a politics and history professor at the Brunel University in London. But espionage was not the only explanation posited. Some people have even argued that the phenomenon was an elaborate prank, but the scale of the stations, multiple frequencies in different languages, makes that explanation seem far-fetched. Fernandez notes that any prankster would need to buy millions of dollars worth of radio transmitters. Despite the general veil of secrecy around espionage, the odd bit of corroborative evidence for the purpose of number stations has leaked out. The purpose of number stations has been guessed at, first by anonymous leaks, stories of people being arrested with radios and one-time pads and other scattered pieces of evidence, as well as some privately published books and magazines, says Fernandez. The one-time pads enabled a form of code that would have been uncrackable to anyone listening in. In 1989, a Czech spy was arrested in the United Kingdom because his equipment was faulty and it radiated into other people's flats. He was unlucky. Experts are confident that number stations do still exist, even if there are fewer of them. In the same way spy tricks such as pretending to feed ducks around a pond might still exist, number stations still do, says Al Bolton, a radio amateur. It's an old-fashioned means of communication, but you have to think of security. Computers almost always leave traces, whereas a paper and a pen are easy to destroy. The danger with a computer is that if you get caught, the data on it is still retrievable, whereas with a one-time pad, you can eat it or flush it down the toilet, he says. In the 2010 raids on a Russian spy ring in the U.S., court papers alleged that they had used coded radio transmissions and encrypted data, a hint that they might have received their orders via shortwave number stations. Despite all the clues, no government has officially admitted or denied using number stations, nor have intelligence agencies. Once the CONET project was released, some spy agencies admitted they were not for public consumption. This is as near to an admission as we've been able to obtain, Fernandez added. Enthusiasts might be fighting skeptics about the station's real purpose, but what is certain is that they aren't a pure product of imagination. If you don't believe so, get yourself a shortwave radio, wait until nighttime, and then scanning for them, Fernandez says, and then listen and wonder. We'll be right back. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service.
Experts say civilians are not ready for an EMP-caused blackout. This article is by Josh Peterson in The Watchdog on April 21st, 2014. The catastrophic effect of an electromagnetic pulse-caused blackout could be preventable, but experts warn the civilian world is still not ready. Peter Vincent Pry, Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and Director of the United States Nuclear Strategy Forum, both congressional advisory boards, said that the technology to avoid disaster from an electromagnetic pulse exists, and upgrading the nation's electrical grid is financially viable. "The problem is not the technology," Pry said. "We know how to protect against it. It's not the money. It doesn't cost that much. The problem is the politics. It always seems to be the politics that get in the way." He said the more officials plan, the lower the estimate costs get. If you do a smart plan, the Congressional EMP Commission estimates that you could protect the whole country for about $2 billion, Pry told the Watchdog.org website. "That's what we give away in foreign aid to Pakistan every year. In the first few minutes of an EMP, nearly 500,000 people would die. That's the worst-case scenario that author William R. Forshin estimated in 2011, and would be the result of an EMP on the electrical grid, whether by an act of God or a nuclear missile detonating in the Earth's upper atmosphere. An electromagnetic pulse is a burst of electromagnetic energy strong enough to disable and even destroy nearby electronic devices. The scenario sounds like something from a Hollywood film, but the U.S. military has been preparing its electronic systems for such an event since the Cold War. The protective measures taken to harden facilities against a nuclear attack also help, in some cases, to protect against EMPs. The civilian world is yet another story. States have been working to fill in the legislative and regulatory gap left by Congress, as previous reports by Watchdog.org and private companies have been developing technologies that would protect against EMPs. In 2011, the State Utilities Commissioner recognized the need to invest in equipment that could help protect the power grid, but experts continue to warn that time to do so is running out. Much focus during the past several years has been placed on society's cybersecurity vulnerabilities. Sophisticated computer hackers working in secret, most likely sponsored by nation states, can easily steal identities, money, and even potentially hijack airplanes. National Geographic, in the movie American Blackout, explored the catastrophic effects of a cyber attack on the grid and what it would do to society. The movie premiered in October of 2013 at the National Geographic magazine in Washington, D.C., accompanied by a panel of national security experts from the U.S. intelligence community. Cyber attacks against the grid are possible. Stuxnet, a computer virus developed by the United States and Israel to sabotage Iran's nuclear enrichment program, demonstrated that such an attack is not only possible, but it can be done. Computer viruses are software programs designed to attack specific entities. But even computers need electricity, otherwise they're little more than an expensive paperweight. Electricity is the lifeblood of the modern world. Food, transportation, medical facilities, and communication systems all need it to function. An EMP attack from a nuclear missile launched by a country like North Korea, on the other hand, would indiscriminately cripple whole regions. Unlike nation states, which can be deterred through diplomacy and force, however, the universe acts on its own accord. An EMP from a super solar flare would behave similarly to the one generated by a nuclear missile that detonates in Earth's upper atmosphere. Solar flares are explosions on the surface of the sun, coronal mass ejections, or CMEs. A solar flare accompanying an EMP can disrupt the space weather around the Earth and affect communication signals traveling through the upper atmosphere, including the ionosphere. On multiple occasions during the past 155 years, large enough CMEs have disrupted electrical systems on Earth. one of the largest recorded solar flares happened in 1859. The CME, called the Carrington event, disrupted telegraph systems in Europe and North America and lit up the evening sky. A solar flare in 1989 caused a blackout in Quebec that lasted more than 9 hours, and systems as far away as New Jersey were also damaged. In 2013, Space.com ranked the solar storm that caused the blackout as the fourth worst in history. Space.com ranked a solar storm in December of 2006 as the worst, and U.S. government officials reported that the event disrupted satellite communications and GPS signals for about 10 minutes and damaged the satellites that took the picture of the storm. A joint study published in 2013 by researchers at Lloyd's of London and the Atmospheric and Environmental Research Team found that a similar event today would cost the world's economy some $2.3 trillion. Risks of another Carrington-class solar flare are expected to peak by early 2015. In the summer of 2012, Earth narrowly missed one estimated to have been more powerful than the Carrington event and 35 times the size of the Earth. This story was written by Josh Peterson, who can be contacted at jpeterson, P-E-T-E-R-S-O-N, at watchdog.com. And you can follow Josh on Twitter at jdpeterson.
Get that Saturday night feeling all week long. Good time feeling coming on strong. KTTS.